This news brief brought to you by the International News Net.
U.S. officials say there's growing evidence Pakistan's ISI spy agency encouraged a Pakistani militant group, the Haqqani Network, to carry out last week's attack on the U.S. Embassy and NATO headquarters in Kabul. A U.S. Senate committee voted this week to make $1 billion in U.S. aid to flood-ravaged Pakistan, conditional on a crackdown on militant groups. Former Afghan President Burhanuddin Rabbani was killed Tuesday in a suicide bombing. A survivor of the attack, an aide to the former president, said Rabbani was lured to his death by the bomber, who claimed he was representing a mysterious figure mediating between the government and the Taliban's senior leadership. NATO leaders Wednesday authorized a 90-day extension of the alliance's mission in Libya. NATO began enforcement of a four-month no-fly zone over Libya in March. NATO fighter jets have flown more than 20,000 sorties over Libya, dropping thousands of bombs to take out Muammar Gaddafi's command centers and military materiel. Hundreds of civilians have been reported killed. Amnesty International says it has uncovered evidence that rebel forces in Libya have committed gross human rights abuses, some amounting to war crimes. The rights group also reveals the Western media deliberately ignored or covered up the widespread atrocities. In a report released Tuesday, Amnesty accuses the rebels of unlawful killings, arbitrary arrests, and widespread torture of civilians, mostly black foreigners. The report also confirms widely held concerns about the NTC's ability to unite the country and oversee a peaceful transition. Many attacks are focused on blacks suspected of being sympathetic to ousted dictator Muammar Gaddafi. The report states angry groups of supporters of the February 17th revolution shot, hanged, and lynched dozens of captured soldiers and suspected foreign mercenaries, and did so with total impunity. Gaddafi's supporters have accused NATO of killing up to 800 civilians. Amnesty says both the NTC and Gaddafi's forces are to blame. U.S. combat troops in Iraq may be heading to the exits, but the U.S. government's enormously expensive intervention there is hardly coming to an end. U.S. officials are planning to expand the gargantuan embassy in Baghdad, a heavily fortified, self-contained compound the size of Vatican City, by far the largest embassy the world has ever seen. Inside its high walls, guard towers and machine gun emplacements ring not just the embassy itself, but more than 20 other buildings. The number of personnel under the authority of the U.S. ambassador will swell from 8,000 to about 16,000.
More details on these stories, visit innworldreport.net.
You are listening to the Rule of Law Radio Network at ruleoflawradio.com. Live free speech talk radio at its best.
Hi, you're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, broadcasting on the 28th of October, 2011. My name's Hereward Fenton. Welcome to another show. Today I've got an interview coming up with Jess Moore from Stop CSG Illawarra. CSG stands for Coal Seam Gas, and there is a huge nationwide movement and globally as well against the process of extracting gas from coal seams, sometimes known as fracking. This is a technique which has become extremely prevalent in Australia and in the US and probably in other countries, and we'll find out more about that in our interview. And it creates a lot of problems environmentally because it creates... there's a toxicity problem because of the chemicals that it puts into the ground, which go into the water table. It also releases gas, which goes into the environment and quite often makes living conditions very bad in people's homes in rural areas. But it's not just rural areas. Apparently, there's been exploratory drilling for coal seam gas in Sydney. And again, we'll find out more about that during our interview. One thing that I want to point out is that this type of activity was sold to us in the early stages as clean energy. It was sold to us as a low greenhouse type of energy solution. And to me, that's a really important example of why the environmental movement needs to, I guess, get its affairs in order and understand how it has been hijacked and how well-intentioned groups who do want to protect the environment, who do want to have a better quality of living, are simply being used by corporatist interests and steered into the directions that they want things to go. Now, of course, the Greens are now against coal seam gas, but the point that I want to make is that in the initial stages, this was actually promoted and still is being promoted from within the government as a low carbon form of energy. So, you know, returning to the constant theme of this show about the carbon tax, the climate change issue being essentially a phony issue designed to manipulate, to control, using environmentalism and using the concept of collective action and the greater good, again, to bring in top-down changes to the way we live, changes to the way things are done, which actually punish the individual, which actually hurt people. But then it's sold to you because they say, well, this is actually for the greater good. This is for the good of the planet. And the same thing applies to the carbon taxes. The same thing applies to ways that they want to, you know, limit your use of energy, and even talk, and which is quite common in environmental circles, about limiting the number of children you might be allowed to have. Again, it's actually all about bringing in a top-down collectivist control structure, which again is not what it seems to be. It is not really the collective who is running it. And this is the point that a lot of people get caught on and don't understand when they think about the good side of a collectivist approach. They think it is actually all the people acting together with consensus to make a better world. But when these systems go into place, they tend to get controlled from interests who become the voice of what the collective is, and that then controls everything. And it ends up becoming an elitist agenda. It's a very strange phenomenon, because it's actually kind of a mirror opposite of what it seems to be. And I'm going to get more into the coal seam gas shortly in our interview, but just on the theme there of how well-intentioned social movements get co-opted, I just want to play a clip here which was posted on Prison Planet today, and it addresses some of those themes. So just have a bit of a listen to this. This is titled "An Open Message to the 99% Occupy Wall Street."
This is an open message to the Occupy Wall Street movement, to the 99%. Revolutions are dangerous and unpredictable beasts. And for a population to enter into one without fully understanding what's at stake is a lot like handing a loaded 45 automatic to a toddler. On the other hand, all it takes is a cursory look at the psychopathic criminals which have taken control of the governments of the world to understand why a revolution is inevitable. This is why it's so important that people who are pushing for change take the time and the effort to deeply consider how we got into this mess and what the real solution is. Otherwise, this movement, like so many others which have come before, will be co-opted, twisted and distorted and could result in even more power being handed to those who you're trying to fight. Now, you have every reason to be angry. You, your children, and your children's children have been sold into slavery. Literally. If you're lucky enough to have a job in the years to come, you'll end up paying between 25 and 30% of your income in taxes, the majority of which will go directly towards paying interest on debts to privately owned banks.
Now, I'll just leave it there. You can watch the rest of it on our show notes. The point there about taxes, well, we already pay 25 to 30% of our income in taxes in Australia. So that's already pretty much standard for us. The thrust of this video is towards libertarianism. It is towards understanding the essential concepts of liberty as opposed to the concept that we must impose order by force. And that is the central problem with the types of solutions that are being offered by all the groups who come from a socialist, collectivist, left-wing angle. And I'm by no means promoting either side in the phony left-right paradigm. I do think it's very important for society to take care of people. I do think a safety net is important. I am not a selfish person, greedy capitalist who doesn't care and doesn't think that we have a responsibility to take care of people. However, a solution which involves surrendering your power to a government which is then empowered to use force to impose regimes upon the population is something which needs to be understood. The solutions are not simple. Government has the potential to always become tyrannical. So there must be so many checks and balances to prevent that from occurring. And personally, what I believe is necessary is that the individuals in society must become mobilized, awakened, and basically realize that it is up to them to prevent tyranny from taking place. I mean, any system that you set up, which is centrally managed, can become tyrannical if you get lazy, if you get complacent, if you just say, oh, you take care of it and just do, you know, do what you do and just, you know, take care of it and we'll just do our thing and you do your thing. And, you know, that's part of the problem that we've got now is that our entire society, many people are quite intelligent, many people are able to take action. They don't. They've got lazy and the tyranny is actually just increasing. It is actually just escalating month by month, year by year. So, again, it's all part and it's all interconnected with the topics in relation to the environment and climate change and the carbon taxes and the coal seam gas mining, which we're going to hear about shortly. Now, a couple more topics I want to talk about today, just a little bit about Libya. I've got an article here from theguardian.co.uk. British firms urged to pack suitcases in rush for Libya business. New Defence Secretary says companies should be ready to cash in on reconstruction contracts in newly liberated Libya. The starting pistol for British firms to pursue contracts in Libya has been fired by the new Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, who urged companies to pack their suitcases and head there to secure reconstruction contracts. As NATO announced that it plans to wind up operations in Libya, Hammond said that great care had been taken during the campaign to avoid destroying critical infrastructure. Well, you know, they did blow up a hell of a lot of buildings, and I'm looking at photographs now of Sirte, which is, it's just been destroyed. It's like Fallujah. There's been comparisons made to that. And I guess the point here to make is that this, again, this whole predatory globalist shock doctrine kind of way of using catastrophe for economic gain is beautifully illustrated here in Libya. And, of course, the obscene way in which Colonel Gaddafi was dispatched just takes it to another level. And I really think that world leaders need to realize that they could be in the line of this type of treatment too. I mean, Tony Blair used to socialize with Muammar Gaddafi. Tony Blair flew to Libya a number of times on Gaddafi's own private jet. They used to sit around talking and chatting, having drinks together. And Gaddafi died with a rifle butt up his rectum, a rifle barrel up his rectum, and was beaten to death and then shot, beaten and then shot in the head. So that was the end of Colonel Gaddafi. And before we go to our interview, I want to play as a final reminder of the sheer wickedness of the politicians who allow this to happen, a short clip from Hillary Clinton. I just think it's really important for you to actually hear this. This is Hillary Clinton talking about her visit to Libya and what happened.
So, I mean, that is the land of unconfirmed.
Yes, we came, we saw, he died.
Did it have anything to do with your visit?
No, I'm sure it did.
There you have it. She was laughing, and to her, it's great. It's great. It's great that he died. And that is the keynote of the mentality that's actually driving everything. It's actually becoming increasingly sociopathic, increasingly disconnected from reality. So anyway, we don't really have time to get into any more of that. I've got a break coming up and our interview coming very shortly. Please stand by.
Corn and Bullion is a family-owned and operated business that has helped many families and friends in protecting their assets, and we would like to do the same for you. In addition to coins and bullion, we now offer Patriot safes, ammunition, Berkey water products, gift certificates, wristbands, and our new silver pool, a new way to guarantee silver by prepaying at a locked price. We can even help you set up a metals IRA account. Call us at 512-646-6440 for more details. As always, we buy, sell, and trade precious metals and cater to those with all sizes of coin collections. We're located at 7304 Burnett Road, Suite A, about a half a mile north of Koenig, next to the Ikebon Sushi and the Genie Car Wash. We're open Monday through Friday, 10 to 6, Saturdays, 10 to 5. Visit us at CapitalCoinAndBullion.com or call 512-646-6440.
Are you being harassed by debt collectors with phone calls, letters, or even lawsuits? Stop debt collectors now with the Michael Maris Proven Method. Michael Maris has won 6 cases in federal court against debt collectors, and now you can win too. You'll get step-by-step instructions in plain English on how to win in court using federal civil rights statutes, what to do when contacted by phone, mail, or court summons, how to answer letters and phone calls, how to get debt collectors out of your credit report, how to turn the financial tables on them and make them pay you to go away. The Michael Maris Proven Method is the solution for how to stop debt collectors. Personal consultation is available as well. For more information, please visit ruleoflawradio.com and click on the blue Michael Maris banner or email michaelmaris@yahoo.com. That's ruleoflawradio.com or email michaelmiras@yahoo.com to learn how to stop debt collectors now.
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Welcome back to the show. Well, as promised earlier, I have on the line Jess Moore from Stop Coal Seam Gas Mining in the Illawarra, stopcsg-illawarra.org, and a really important and extremely relevant issue to all the things that are going on in the environment at the moment. This one, as I was describing earlier, is global in reach. There's so many different things going on, particularly in the US, that are having a huge impact on people's lives, on people's quality of life, on health, and also in their personal sovereignty and the jurisdiction over people's private land. This issue really cuts across so many different sort of political, social, and environmental issues that it's just become one of the major things. It hasn't really been given the level of attention in the media that it needs. I mean, it has been in the media to a certain extent, but it hasn't really been, looking at some of the protests here that have been absolutely huge, there hasn't been much coverage of them. So I'd just like to say to Jess, welcome to Truth News Radio Australia.
Oh, hello, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure. Great pleasure having you on. And your name was put to me by John Bursell, who is actually a regular on this show. He's also heavily involved in the anti-CSG groups. And I just would like to maybe start, Jess, by getting a bit of a background of coal seam gas mining. It's actually goes by different names in different countries, I believe. But the technique, of course, is extracting gas from the seams in between the coal. And I think it's at a depth that is too deep to actually mine the coal, but they can actually get the gas out of the coal. Now, I'll leave it to you maybe to describe a little bit about the background and how long it's been going and where it's actually been done in the world.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I guess one thing to say quite clearly is that coal seam gas mining is actually something that's been going on for quite a long time.
Okay.
But it's the newer extraction methods, which are really quite destructive, that's made it commercially viable.
I see.
So for a long time, coal seams have been mined for methane, but to get the methane out to make it safe for coal mining.
Right, right.
But now we've entered a new period where actually mining for the gas itself it works commercially for companies, and that's through sort of a whole number of new methods. I guess kind of a key thing to say, because I'm very new to this, I think most people are very new to this.
Sure.
Because it is so new.
Mm.
But I guess the clearest thing to explain is that what we've got in all of our coal seams is gas that's trapped, and it's trapped by the presence of water that's also in those seams, so it's trapped under hydrostatic pressure.
Okay.
And actually to get that gas out, you have to remove the water from the coal seam, depressurize it, and then the gas starts to flow.
Right.
And so one of the principal concerns is that water that comes out of the coal seam is always contaminated. So it's high in salt, so high in salt a lot of the time that it destroys soil and everything that grows in it. But it also can contain radioactive and toxic compounds and heavy metals, which of course have huge implications for health.
So the water is driven up, is it sort of pumped up and out of the ground? Is that what happens?
Yeah, that's right. You actually have to extract it to get access to the gas. And at the moment, what's done with that water varies quite a lot. So everything from using a regular water treatment plant, desalinization plant, through to putting it in ponds, open-air ponds that are lined with builder's plastic, which means you end up with a highly concentrated sludge, of course, as clean water evaporates off.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So is this a technique being used? I know it's in the US a lot. Are many other countries doing it for actual gas extraction?
Yeah, I mean, basically since 2005, Halliburton developed a technique called hydraulic fracturing, or fracking.
Right.
And it was the massive step forward. That, combined with horizontal drilling, really made this an industry that could make a lot of money. So a lot of the problems that we're seeing in the US are because of this method, hydraulic fracturing. And what that involves is actually the direct contamination of large quantities of water that are then pumped into the ground under high pressure to fracture the coal seam.
Right, right.
So that they do this to actually increase the speed at which the gas comes out.
Right, right. And of course, it's being done over huge swathes of land in the United States. And, of course, it's being done on private land. And this is, again, one of the central issues about it is that the mineral rights are not generally owned by the landholders, and that's true in the United States. It's also true in Australia, and of course they can just come in and they can start pretty much without your permission. Can you maybe explain a little bit of the process of that? Because it just seems so shocking when you first discover that actually can occur. But I've been reading some things. Apparently, the Queensland government put out a little brochure to farmers where it said, you should be polite to the mining people and not argue with them too much. And, because remember, they can just come into your land and they can, the tone of the brochure is that, you better just behave yourself because they've basically got the power over you.
Yeah, I mean, the government's doing that because, of course, people in Queensland aren't, in inverted commas, behaving themselves,
right.
Thankfully,
right.
Because they're actually standing up to some of these companies. But, yeah, it's basically the case in both Queensland and New South Wales that we don't own the surface of our property.
Yeah.
So at the moment, you have to be compensated if a wellhead goes on your property. It's my understanding, I don't know if this is the case all around Australia, but the level of compensation varies. It's up to what the company offers you. But, a company can drill under your property without even talking to you about it.
Right.
So if they're not putting a wellhead on your property because they've got this ability to drill horizontally, they can drill under your property and not even talk to you about it. There's kind of two issues at play here because, of course, there's the enormous issue, which we're seeing particularly in agricultural areas, of people not really having the formal right to resist this technology, even though it's going to destroy agricultural land. But of course, there's other examples across Australia where public land, people aren't part of the decision for that land to be used for coal seam gas mining, which is, of course, a massive problem as well. Our collective right to say, no, this is our land and we don't want it here either.
Right, so that's just being unilaterally decided by the government, really with no... how do they make the decision on that? It's just a government decision to sell those rights to the mining exploration. Is that how it's done?
Well, so in New South Wales, the government issues petroleum exploration licences,
right.
Which designate an area of land in which companies not only get the rights to search, they actually have to search or they lose the licence. But there are some limitations around people initially saying yes or no, but there's a massive problem when if you've got a property owner, if you're wedged between two property owners who give companies permission to put a wellhead on their property, then effectively you are going to be in a gas field and you can't stop that.
Right, right, yeah.
Yeah. I guess the other key thing to say is that, so companies often talk about exploration versus production. So when you first explore for coal seam gas, you don't need to drill many wells. What you're trying to do is show that there's enough gas there that you can get access to support investment in a production field.
Right.
And often people are approached with, we would like to put one well on your property, pay you, say, $1,500 a year for it to be there. It's not going to cause you any harm. It's just sort of sitting there down the back of your property. But what you find is that when production then gets approved for that gas field is that the company had plans in its pocket to put 20 wells on your property connected by roads and pipelines, and you're really quite powerless to actually stop that production field coming up on your property.
Really? So they'll start with one? And then they'll have a plan to do another 20, sort of in the pipeline.
Yeah, obviously you don't ever explore
of course.
Without the intent of moving
course.
On into production.
Of course, but they probably don't fully explain to you the consequences of what's going to happen. They probably don't emphasise that to you. Hey, you're going to be living in a gas field. Yeah, you wouldn't want to talk about that too much if you thought that the person was going to react badly to that. So I'd imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, the experience right across the US and now kind of in Queensland where coal seam gas mining is more advanced, we've seen time and time again that, landowners are approached, asked to put a well on their property, and they find out down the track that there were quite advanced plans for what was projected for production. And they were never shown these plans, what it looked like, how it would actually impact on their properties.
Sure, sure. So we've got the issue of... that mining companies be able to go into people's property in some cases without their permission. We've got drilling into like adjacent properties that can go under the ground, directly under their land, and we've got the use of public lands without really the informed consent of the population, that can just completely, you know, devastate the environment and huge amounts of our land, of our crown land, essentially. So look, we're just going to break, and we'll get back more into Stop CSG Illawarra after the break.
This is Building 7, a 47-story skyscraper that fell on the afternoon of September 11th.
The government says that fire brought it down. However, 1,500 architects and engineers concluded it was a controlled demolition.
Over 6,000 of my fellow service members have given their lives.
And thousands of my fellow first responders are dying.
I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
I'm a structural engineer.
I'm a New York City correction officer.
I'm an Air Force pilot.
I'm a father who lost his son.
We're Americans, and we deserve the truth.
Go to rememberbuilding7.org today.
Could printed books soon be a thing of the past? Apparently, a lot of kids these days are exchanging book pages for web pages. I'm Dr. Catherine Albrecht, and I'll be back to tell you what's happening to literacy.
Privacy is under attack. When you give up data about yourself, you'll never get it back again. And once your privacy is gone, you'll find your freedoms will start to vanish too. So protect your rights, say no to surveillance, and keep your information to yourself. Privacy, it's worth hanging on to. This public service announcement is brought to you by StartPage.com, the private search engine alternative to Google, Yahoo, and Bing. Start over with StartPage.
Forget books and magazines. A recent study by the UK's National Literacy Trust found that text messages are the number one reading material for kids today, and numbers 2 and 3 are email and Facebook. That's not surprising, since cell phones and computers outnumber novels in most homes. We adults are obviously not setting a very good example. Of course, text messages are not known for their literary quality or for their outstanding spelling and grammar. In fact, they're some of the worst writing around. So if you want your kids to develop basic English skills, tell them to unplug from Facebook and turn off Twitter, then hand them an old-fashioned book. I'm Dr. Catherine Albrecht. More news and information at CatherineAlbrecht.com.
Welcome back to the show. I'm here today talking with Jess Moore from Stop CSG Illawarra, and the website for that is stop-csg-illawarra.org. We'll have that information in the show notes. We've been talking about the land rights issues in terms of coal seam gas mining. Can we talk a little bit, Jess, about the actual environmental and health issues specifically with CSG? What are the effects on people and what are the effects on the land?
Well, I guess the starting point for that question, which is really important, is this is a very under-researched industry.
Yeah.
So there's actually a real lack of scientific evidence about exactly what we're risking when we mine for coal seam gas. But that said, there's large amounts of anecdotal evidence, communities who are experiencing the effects of coal seam gas mining, and now a little bit research into how some of those effects are caused, that kind of thing. Now, the main environmental impact is around water.
Yeah.
So I said earlier that the contaminated water that has to be drawn out of the coal seam to access the gas, that's a big problem. So the industry itself doesn't know how it's going to deal with the enormous quantities of water, contaminated water, that we are talking about. So there was one projection that says over the next 25 years, we're going to get the equivalent of 11 Sydney harbours full of co-produced contaminated water that the industry is going to have to deal with. And that's just huge quantities of water to have to process. And I guess a really important thing to say there is that this water isn't tested for every possible contaminant.
Yeah, yeah.
It's based on what the government has decided are the things we need to test for. The next thing with water is that hydraulic fracturing or fracking, as I was talking out before, directly contaminates enormous quantities of fresh water.
Right.
So a single well takes about 3 million gallons of water to fracture.
Right.
And you don't know how much of that water you're going to be able to get back out of the ground. So you usually get between 20% and 80% back out of the ground. There's a huge degree of variability, which means we are releasing contaminants into the underground environment when we frack. Now, what those contaminants are largely protected under proprietary rights.
I see.
So companies don't have to tell us what they're pumping into the ground when they do this. And there was a study in the US that identified over 750 toxic chemicals that coal seam gas mining companies were using. Now, that doesn't mean every company is using all 750 chemicals, but that's what they've identified over contamination instances, basically, in the US.
And, of course, these chemicals will go into the underground aquifers.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a large number of problems with aquifers. This is the third issue when it comes to water. We're disturbing the underground water system. So when you're drilling through aquifers, you can affect things like flow, direction, that kind of thing.
Right.
Obviously, when we're drawing large quantities of water out of the ground, we're going to affect the levels of underground water systems. And, of course, when we're pumping contaminated water into the ground, that can contaminate these underground water systems. Now, in a country like Australia, where we actually rely on underground water systems in central Australia, and actually even in areas along the coast, there have been studies into using groundwater as a water supply when we go into periods of drought. It's complete madness to be risking those underground water supplies.
Yeah, it's a really hard thing to probably measure or predict what would happen. And, of course, if they don't disclose what's in the chemicals, we can't really know anyway, can we? So that's under proprietary restriction, is it?
Yeah, so it's just like we don't know what the special sauce on our Big Mac is.
Right.
We aren't being told what's been pumped into the ground. So that's an enormous problem given the risks that we face.
Sure.
I mean, even the Ross Dunn from Appia, the peak body around coal seam gas mining, has actually said damage to aquifers is inevitable.
Right.
And he says it's up to the industry to try to reduce or minimise that damage.
Now, in addition to that, of course, there's also the problem of gas leaking out and coming out into the environment and going into the water supply.
Yeah, so it's actually... when we draw that contaminated water out of the coal seam, it contains methane as well,
because it's been
sitting down there in that coal seam with methane.
Yes.
And this is called entrained methane, so it's actually dissolved in bubbles in that water.
Mm.
Now, again, incredibly difficult to get figures on exactly how much methane we're talking about, but there's a study from Wyoming in the US that showed on average they were getting about 14 or 15% of the methane down there coming up in that water.
Mm.
Now that's and up to 30%, so large quantities of methane in that water. And for anyone who's kind of seen Gasland or some of the coverage now in Australia, we can actually get water that is flammable.
Mm.
So people turning on their taps and being able to light their drinking water on fire because there's that much methane in it.
Has this happened in Australia?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah. So I don't know if you've seen, there was a Four Corners episode that actually covered this.
Right.
But it's particularly with people who are reliant on groundwater. They're finding that their bore water, when it comes up, has got methane in it as a result of the, well, I can't say directly as a result of the coal seam gas mining because
yeah.
no one's done the study, but coal seam gas mining started. Now their water is flammable.
have the coal seam gas mining companies admitted anything in relation to that, or are they just saying it's not... nothing to do with us? Are they just saying it just happened by coincidence?
They're not admitting fault. That's probably the clearest way to say it.
But I mean who's ever heard of flammable water? I mean, I've never... like, I've seen the trailers for Gasland. I haven't seen the film. But the first time I saw it, I mean, I've never heard of such a thing. I've never heard of such a thing that you would have flammable water.
Yeah,
is there a history of that?
It's such a shocking image.
It is, isn't it? It is. It's absolutely shocking.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, that is an incredibly frightening thing in and of itself, but I guess the other important thing to say is because coal seam gas is principally methane, which is highly flammable, that's not the only part of the process where we get leakage. So obviously that's leakage when it's coming up in water and that kind of thing, but also processing plants, pipelines, wellheads, they leak.
Right.
And so you can get explosions on wellheads.
Yeah.
And you can get pipelines... and processing plants that are releasing methane into the atmosphere. And of course, this is an incredibly potent greenhouse gas. It's 105 times worse over a 20-year period in terms of global warming potential than carbon dioxide.
Yeah, of course, methane is a very strong greenhouse gas, and I certainly am aware of that. Just a question also about the direct effect on people, because I've seen a documentary where people were describing the smell of the gas as being basically overpowering, and this was, I think, in Wyoming or somewhere like that, and they complained, and they put in complaints to the government, to the health authorities or whatever, and they were simply told, look, when the gas is bad, just don't go outside.
Yeah.
And I think people are being told not to hang their washing outside as well.
Yeah, people, basically communities are being treated with contempt. And in a way that's incredibly scary. You know, people should have the right to clean air. But right across the US in communities where coal seam gas mining is happening, and actually other forms of unconventional gas mining as well, people reporting, massive changes in their health. So coal seam gas mining has been linked to things like neurological problems, cancer, heart, kidney, lung problems, asthma, but actually getting proof, you know, in inverted commas, I guess, that coal seam gas mining has a causal effect is, of course, incredibly difficult.
But then of course, you get the typical war of experts where the industry will hire their own experts, just like the smoking, you know, lobbies used to do, to try and basically say, well, you know, this doesn't really prove causality. You know, it's always going to be difficult to prove these things, just as it was difficult to prove that smoking caused cancer. You know what I mean? But I mean,
yeah.
It's actually, to me, so obvious that if you've got strong smelling odor that's overwhelming, that was invading your home, that it wouldn't be good for you. I mean, it's on a very basic common sense level that you'd have to know that that is actually going to damage your health.
Yeah, it's amazing. Frankly, it's astounding how little common sense has credibility in the debate. You know, when it's blatantly obvious that if you're finding stuff like BTEX, which is toxic chemicals, in your drinking water supply,
you know,
obviously that's got health implications. But we're kind of stuck in this situation at the moment where unless you've got that scientific proof and someone has to commit to doing that independent research, how do we actually show that causal relationship? And I guess one of the really clear examples in Australia, so the coal seam gas mining industry claims to be cleaner in terms of global warming potential than coal mining, but there's still not a single peer-reviewed life cycle analysis of coal seam gas versus coal. So how do we actually know that? And the industry claims they've done a study, and they know it's cleaner, but they won't release that study to the public or for peer review. And so we're stuck in this situation of the industry making claims where it says they've done the research, but they're not even showing it to the public.
It really seems like a game of words and a game of definitions where the goalposts can be continually moved. And, you know, it just reminds me a little bit of what happened in Japan with the Fukushima nuclear accident, where, you know, first of all, they denied there was a problem with radiation. Then they admitted there was radiation, but then they actually said that they were going to raise the level at which they would say radiation was actually dangerous. So in other words, there is this tendency with these big organizations and governments together to just redefine language to mean different things. So I think it's going to be really hard. I think, you know, even with these scientific studies that you're doing, it's going to be really hard to make any traction, because they're just going to basically, they're going to look at a scientific study and they're going to say, well, that means that, but this means this, and we've got another study that says something else. So, you know, that's an unfortunate situation that we're in. We're just going to second break, and we'll come back with one more segment. Are you good for one more segment with us, Jess?
Yeah, that's absolutely fine.
Great.
The Oklahoma City bombing. Top 10 reasons to question the official story. Reason number 2, why was the ATF AWOL? Paramedic Tiffany Bible, who was on the scene within 5 minutes, has stated in an affidavit that agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms told her that they were not in their office that morning. EMT Catherine Mallett also overheard one agent say to another, quote, "Is that why we got the page to not come in today?" End quote. Bruce Shaw, as interviewed on KFOR-TV, was also told by ATF agents that they had been paged to not come into work. The ATF initially denied these claims and now variously claim that one of their agents was in a free-falling elevator, which has been disproven, or that they'd been in an all-night stakeout, or that they'd been at a golf tournament. As they try to sort out their lies, all we want to know is, did the ATF receive a warning, and if so, why did they not pass it on to others in the Mirabelle? For more information, go to OKCBombingTruth.com.
At hempusa.org, we offer chemical-free products to people around the world, detoxifying, self-healing, while rebuilding the immune system. We urge our listeners to please consider our largest-selling product, Microplant Powder. Our microplant powder is rich in silica and probiotics to help rebuild the immune system and to create a healthy stomach flora. Microplant powder is excellent for daily intake and is perfect to add to your storage shelter. We urge our listeners to please visit us at hempusa.org. And remember, all of our products are chemical-free and healthy to eat. We constantly strive to give you the best service, highest quality, and rapid shipping anywhere. And we offer free shipping on orders over $95 in the U.S. Please visit us at hempusa.org or call 908-691-2608. That's 908-691-2608. See what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you at hempusa.org.
When you're sick of the propaganda, when you're over the disinformation, when you can't stand the deception, when the deceit gets too much, when the spin becomes transparent, you know where to turn. You turn on truthnews.com.au with your hosts, Harold Fenton and Joshua Jackson.
Welcome back to Truth News. We're talking about coal seam gas mining in Australia, and we're talking to Jess Moore. And I want to get into a little bit about your group now, Jess. Stop CSG Illawarra. Illawarra. What does Illawarra cover? What's the actual sort of geographical area of Illawarra?
So it runs from just south of the Royal National Park, so from South Sydney.
Sure.
It runs right down to sort of the Kiama area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, big area, fairly heavily populated too. I mean, it's not urban, but you know, there's a lot of people living in that area, and it's beautiful land too. It's really, really gorgeous land, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, most of us all live below or on the side of the Illawarra Escarpment.
Right. Right.
And our area is actually responsible for the most reliable source of drinking water for Sydney, so particularly South Sydney, the Illawarra and the Southern Highlands.
Oh, that's interesting. So that's not the Warragamba Dam though, is it?
It feeds back towards Warragamba Dam.
Oh, okay, right, okay.
So we're on the Warranora and Nepean catchments.
Okay, well, that makes it all the more serious, doesn't it? That makes it really critical that you guys make some progress with what you're doing, because that's going to affect everyone. It's going to affect the whole of Sydney.
Absolutely. And I guess, I mean, some of the things we find out more and more, you know, most people in this community had no idea what coal seam gas mining was, or that there were even, you know, wells being put forward for approval. And we all found out after the fact. So we found out after the state government granted approval for exploration in this area.
Right.
And we are, unfortunately, we have 15 coal seam gas wells, exploration wells approved here. And 10 of those are actually on Sydney catchment, in Sydney Catchment Authority special areas, so in our drinking water catchment. So that's land where if I go for a walk, I can be fined $11,000.
Right.
But coal seam gas mining companies have been given permission to drill there.
Well, they're just like gods, aren't they, Jess? I mean, they just basically have all the power, and we've just got to hope that they don't poison us too much. I mean, what can we realistically do short of a revolution to stop this? I mean, how can we, the government corporate relationship is so tight. How do you prize it apart? I mean, they need to be, we need hydrological fracking to separate them.
Well, I think the Illawarra experience really shows, and frankly, the experience right across New South Wales shows, that the only thing that's going to stop this is ordinary people getting involved in the decisions that affect our lives, ordinary people actually standing up to the industry and standing up to the government who is currently representing them, not us.
And there's been some massive protests already, right? There's been some really huge protests.
Yeah, well, in the Illawarra, so we actually formed in March this year. Approvals were granted at the end of 2009, but our group formed in March this year because most of us didn't find out till, well, most people didn't find out till this year, but some of us found out end of last year and since time have been really trying to campaign and let people in the community know what's going on and what our concerns are.
Sure.
What I guess is quite incredible is since that time we had our first big action in May this year and over 3,000 people came.
Okay.
Now, this was in the tiny seaside suburb of Ostermere. We actually went out onto the beach and spelled out, stop coal seam gas. And again, this month, we actually walked along Seacliff Bridge, which is a very iconic bridge, again, in an even smaller community still. And again, 3,000 people came out and marched along that bridge, which is right next to where we've got the approval for the coal seam gas wells.
That's a lot. That's a lot for a small community. That's a big number. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I can't say this definitively, but I think these are the biggest environmental protests we've ever had in the Illawarra, which is quite incredible. And I guess to be really clear, it's not just the Illawarra. We are a group called Stop CSG Illawarra, but at the moment, given where the approvals are, these people are primarily from the very small suburbs in the northern Illawarra. So we actually live, I live in this area as well. We actually live in an area where the escarpment comes very close to the sea. So it's a very thin strip of land that people live along by and large. And we will be essentially, we are risking living beneath a gas field. So one of the astounding things to me, and it actually took me a while to understand this, is that, you know, we're talking exploration at the moment, but they do this to move into production. And a production field means a wellhead every 400 to 900 metres, all connected by roads and pipelines. Those roads have to be really wide because they have to get tankers in and out.
Of course, yeah.
And they have to do a large amount of clearing around each wellhead, so a radius of between 25 and 50 metres of cleared land around each wellhead.
Yeah.
So we're talking about huge amounts of land clearing in an area that Barry O'Farrell is at the moment talking about declaring a national park. This is just south of the Royal.
How ridiculous.
And you know, this is an area that's already been quite heavily mined for coal.
Right, right.
So we've actually got a fault line that runs through our escarpment, and we've also got all of these mines, longwall mines, that are actually designed to subside, so designed to
So these are old. Are they old coal mines from long ago, are they? Or are they still active?
Both, actually.
Right.
So they're not at the moment looking to drill into any active mines for coal seam gas. There's coal mine methane going on just north of this, which is about getting the methane out to mine for coal.
Right.
But these are not active mines. And they're actually, the coal seam gas mining companies here are incredibly excited about this because essentially the upper seams have already been fracked.
Right.
Through the coal mining process. But, of course, they then drill through these fracked top seams and have to go into lower seams where to increase permeability or the rate at which you get the gas, they would be looking at stimulation methods. So that can include hydraulic fracturing, but it can include a whole number of other techniques, including ones that are currently in development. So we've actually got a company who is saying at the moment for exploration, they won't frack. They won't give this to us in writing as an agreement, but they're saying they won't frack. But they say they want to do something called zero radius drilling. And when we contacted them and asked them what that was, they said it's protected under proprietary rights.
Okay, so you don't know what it is.
No, exactly. So it's another stimulation technique. We don't know what it is. And they're talking about doing this in our drinking water catchment in an area that's quite unstable, geologically quite unstable already, in an area next to a fault line, and in bushland that actually plays a really essential role in rainfall in this area, which is so essential to Sydney, the Illawarra and the Southern Highlands.
I mean, surely in order to come to a sensible decision on this, it's not even necessary to go into too much detail with a scientific study. I mean, you've just presented so many risk factors that are so clear that if that doesn't work, I mean, if those clear risks aren't enough to enforce a moratorium on on this type of mining in any kind of sensitive area, then I just can't see what else could work. What is your feeling about that? I mean, what more can be done to convince the people who are essentially making decisions on this?
Well, I think what's incredibly clear at the moment is that no amount of demonstrating the risks is going to convince them. You know, we're not going to say, look, we're really worried about our drinking water, and they're going to go, oh, I'm convinced, and change their position. But what is at the same time quite clear is that these mobilisations of the community are actually starting to have a bit of an impact. So
okay.
There have already been some minor changes, nowhere near enough, at government level in New South Wales as a result of this campaign. And that's, you know, unfortunately, you know, I would much rather be lying on a beach somewhere not worrying about coal seam gas because it's not an issue.
Yeah.
But the fact that people are giving up enormous amounts of their time, committing themselves to this campaign and really coming out and demonstrating their opposition, it's actually starting to force a shift in government policy. And that, to me, really cuts to the heart of this problem, which is about democracy, because communities in general weren't told about this. They weren't told what coal seam gas mining was, or that approvals were being put forward in their community, and they weren't. We weren't given an opportunity to actually respond.
Right. And
so we in the Illawarra, we consistently campaign. We campaign for an immediate moratorium on all coal seam gas mining projects for a royal commission, and we actually very clearly state, you know, the industry should have absolutely no problem with a royal commission if they've got nothing to hide.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we consistently campaign for that outcome, but are very clear on the fact that it's not just going to be calling for those things or pointing out common sense arguments, but actually demonstrating community opposition that will actually force the government to change their position.
Can I just ask, Jess, what's your take on Australia's so-called top environmentalist, Tim Flannery, on his recent statements about coal seam gas mining? What's your take on it? I mean, it was reported in the news as his basically approving of it. Then he denied, he said that was a misrepresentation of his position. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's incredibly hard to know because the Australian reported certain comments from Flannery and he then said they were taken out of context.
Right.
But that said, when he came back to the media and talked about his objection to that, he didn't come out and say, we need an immediate moratorium on coal seam gas mining. He came out and said he was taken out of context. So it's actually incredibly hard to judge his position. Though it's clear he acknowledges there are risks, what's unclear is whether or not he thinks those risks can be overcome or that they're generalised, that sort of thing. And
yeah,
it is,
yeah.
We're in an incredibly hard situation when one individual is given so much authority in terms of, you know, putting forward whether or not he thinks this industry should go ahead. At the end of the day, it's got to come back to communities being presented with the evidence and making a decision for ourselves.
Yeah, it's not, the decision isn't made by experts or individuals. It's made by what the people want, if we are a democracy. The question
Absolutely.
Is, are we a democracy?
That's the big question. And I think, you know, when it comes to this issue, it's really clear just how undemocratic these decisions are.
But one thing that's interesting about this issue that shows that people can come together is you've got a fairly right-wing radio talk show host, Alan Jones, becoming like a really passionate advocate of this issue, which is also advocated by the Greens, despite the fact that he is, you know, completely at tenterhooks with the Greens on other issues. But that and then you've got Tim Flannery appearing to take the side of the corporations. So it's a weird split, but it shows that it's a fluid situation. Look, we're just about out of time. Any final points you'd like to make?
Oh, well, just on that, and I think it's quite an incredible thing, this campaign really brings together people from all different walks of life because, of course, farmers are really threatened by this industry. All of our drinking water is under threat from this industry. And so quite an amazing alliance is building in Australia at the moment among people who are using their common sense to actually stand together and stand up against government policy that's a risk to us all.
Great. That's an excellent summary. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for coming on, Jess.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, hope to talk to you again sometime soon.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Well, that's a wrap from TNRA. See you next week, and please leave some comments on our page and check out our show notes.
The Bible remains the most popular book in the world. Yet countless readers are frustrated because they struggle to understand it. Some new translations try to help by simplifying the text, but in the process can compromise the profound meaning of the scripture. Enter the Recovery Version. First, this new translation is extremely faithful and accurate, but the real story is the more than 9,000 explanatory footnotes. Difficult and profound passages are opened up in a marvelous way, providing an entrance into the riches of the Word beyond which you've ever experienced before. Bibles for America would like to give you a free Recovery Version simply for the asking. This comprehensive yet compact study Bible is yours just by calling us toll-free at 1-888-551-0102 or by ordering online at freestudybible.com. That's freestudybible.com.